Women who are victims of domestic violence can struggle for years to stop the abuse. In a tiny minority of cases, the victim kills the abuser and she's charged with murder or manslaughter. But should we think differently about these crimes? Are abused women acting in self-defence, even if the act is premeditated? That's what a Brisbane jury decided last week. A woman who admitted to killing her husband was nonetheless acquitted of all charges. To find out where that leaves us, I'm joined by Zoe Rathus, the director of the legal clinic at Griffith University's Law School. Hello, Zoe.
Hello, Richard.
This was a premeditated killing. How can it fall within the legal definition of self-defence? Because that usually applies if the person faces an immediate threat, doesn't it?
Look, that's right. And that's been the traditional way that self-defence has been seen in the courts. And what I would argue is that that's because self-defence was originally crafted by men for men. That's the way that men fight, that they get into some kind of an argument, all of a sudden there's a flurry of fists, weapons might get pulled out, even going back to completely different times in history when these laws were being developed. And suddenly they find themselves in a life-threatening situation and use lethal force to kill the other person. And the definition of self-defence in the way that it was drafted really imagines that kind of a situation. But what people have been arguing for a long time who have worked with women who are victims of domestic violence is that sometimes when those women take action against the men who have been their tormentors for so many years, that action is actually morally no different. And in fact, in the mind of the woman, she is doing the same thing. She is preventing herself from dying, or potentially her children or others whom she protects.
So, in effect, and in this case, in fact, the jury interpreted self-preservation to mean to be self-defence.
It seems so. I mean, it's difficult. Of course, I've also only seen the media reports on the case, and no one gets inside the mind of a jury. But it seems that they accepted a proposition that the way that Susan Falls acted amounted to self-preservation. So although what she did didn't look exactly like perhaps the literal words of the defence, what she did was in line with what that defence really is about. And I think that one of the arguments, from what I can see from the media reports, an argument that her defence counsel made, which is an argument which has been made by many feminist lawyers in relation to understanding why women who kill in these circumstances is self-defence, one needs to understand that there is a point for some of these women where they live in a constant state of fear of attack. So whether he's actually attacking her at the time becomes almost immaterial to her state of mind. This woman just lived constantly with the fear that at any moment she would become the subject of one of his attacks.
Well, he certainly wasn't actually attacking her at the time because
she
drugged him and then she killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was unconscious.
Yes. So when I say that, I don't mean that she literally... Well, look, I don't mean that she literally thought that he was going to jump up and kill her then. But what is also interesting is when you read, from what I understand, her evidence, one of the things that she says is that even after she drugged him and shot him, she could still hear him breathing. And she was actually hiding, thinking that almost at any minute he might get up. And I have...
And she came back and shot him later.
Well, that was to make sure that he didn't get up. And I mean, I think that what happens is that these women almost begin to believe that these men are omnipotent, that nothing will actually kill them. So even when she probably had effectively killed him, she actually couldn't believe it yet and was almost still in fear of him.
It's like a horror movie, isn't it? Where you can't kill the evil thing that's coming at you.
No, I think she called him the Terminator at one point because that was how she kind of imagined him. And I guess that what I find interesting is that these kinds of statements are very consistent. I've acted for and worked with, not so much acted for, but worked with as a support, a number of these women. And I have, this is quite a consistent statement, that even after they think they might have killed him, they actually simultaneously think that he is still alive and that at any minute he's going to stand up and attack them. And they are actually so frightened at that point because they know they've done this terribly harming thing to him, which they're not sure has brought about his death. And they are actually in complete fear that he is now actually going to come back and kill them with all the rage that he will feel, thinking that he's just been killed. So these, and this isn't necessarily logical, but
it's not logical.
But the reactions that these women have become illogical to those of us potentially on the outside, and it is why presenting these cases very well by defence counsel, and why the judge's summation to juries becomes so critical, because it is so important with the laws the way they are at the moment that juries really are invited to understand how these laws might apply to a certain extent from the position of that woman. But one has to be very careful about exactly what our laws say, the extent to which a jury is really entitled to put themselves in the shoes of that woman. But they can... they are certainly invited to understand the world as she understood it.
Now, the defence team, Zoe, used the term battered woman defence to explain why she would have acted in this way, Susan Falls. Is that what we've been talking about?
Well, it's a mistake to call it a battered woman defence.
Battered woman syndrome,
that's
I beg your pardon.
Yes. I mean, I don't like that term either, but for different reasons. Yes, look, the idea is that to really understand the way that life starts to look for someone who has been a victim of serious domestic violence, there is a whole new perspective that they have on life. And this is where this constant fear, one of the words that is often used about battered women, is that they live with a kind of hypervigilance. They are always on the lookout. And in fact, in her evidence, she talks about this incredible thing in the mornings of getting his Cocoa Pops to exactly the right texture, not too soft, not too crunchy, and how she had to time it absolutely perfectly when he had his hairdryer on. And this, so the hypervigilance is not just about, oh, he's going to get me next, but is actually about almost every move and the entire way that these women live in their homes is on this tenterhooks of getting everything right all the time to try to appease as often as possible, but when not, to be ready for the strike that is going to come. So this is not the way that most of us live in our homes.
No.
And so the idea with this term battered woman syndrome is that one gives the jury sufficient information about this, coming often from the mouth of the victim herself, or ultimately the perpetrator in the homicide trial. But her evidence, sometimes the evidence of friends or relatives or others who have seen evidence of the violence which has occurred, but also from experts, and there were a couple of experts called in this case who are able to explain some of this situation to a jury. Now, there are some who say that using the word syndrome becomes something of a mistake because it pathologises the woman. It puts everything then into the woman and her victimhood, as opposed to keeping the focus to some extent on the perpetrator of all that violence and the level of his violence and the social context in which women then find themselves and the incredible difficulties that women still have in extricating themselves safely from these relationships.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Zoe Rather. She's director of the legal clinic at Griffith University Law School in Brisbane. We're talking about, women who have suffered usually long periods of domestic violence, who eventually take the law into their own hands and kill the person who is doing this to them, and where they are legally at the moment. Because Zoe, as you know, Queensland recently amended its laws to take into account the particular circumstances of women like these suffering sustained domestic abuse. Did that have a bearing on this case?
Well, that's one of the extremely interesting things, that in fact, the Queensland government brought in a new, what's called a partial defence, to homicide in circumstances where there is a history of severe domestic violence. But the reality is that it was a partial defence. In other words, this defence, so-called, reduces murder to manslaughter, but it is not a complete acquittal. It is not self-defence. It is similar to some of the other things that we have that reduce murder to manslaughter. For example, in Queensland, provocation can still reduce murder to manslaughter. In some states, that has now been abolished. There's also a term called diminished responsibility, which is used in a range of circumstances where people's minds are affected by all kinds of things at the time that they actually commit a homicide. So there are a range of ideas that we have incorporated into our law for a very long time that allow a jury to come back with a verdict of manslaughter rather than murder. And in Queensland, that is particularly important because we still have mandatory life sentence imprisonment for murder. So that if you do get convicted of murder, there is no sentencing discretion for the judge. They must sentence you to prison for life. Whereas if you are convicted of manslaughter, there is a sentencing discretion that then applies.
Well, two things, Zoe. Firstly, that is not what happened, though, is it, last week?
No. So this woman and her defence team decided not to rely on that partial defence, which at the best would have got her a conviction for manslaughter, and rather to go for broke, you might say, and go with the traditional defence of self-defence and hope that she would be successful and fully acquitted.
And she was.
Which is what happened.
Yes. The
now,
other
my
thing.
My argument is that this. So, I mean, I feel half vindicated and half not in terms of the approach that I took to the new legislation. I was very disappointed that the Queensland government didn't go further and didn't recraft the defence of self-defence to allow certain circumstances to lead to a full acquittal. To clarify, I suppose, the circumstances that I think have happened in this case, to make it more straightforward for inappropriate cases, this issue of domestic violence to be argued to sustain a defence of self-defence.
So
now, the government didn't change our law of self-defence.
No. Can I ask you this?
The Attorney General wins because he can say, well, there we go, the defence of self-defence still works. And it obviously does. I still think that we could make things clearer in Queensland and leave out some of the twisting and turning that has to be done to allow juries to draw the factual connections to the law of our current self-defence.
That is where we have to leave it, I'm afraid. But thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Richard.
That's Zoe Rathus, and she's the director of the Legal Clinic at Griffith University Law School in Brisbane. Obviously keen to hear from you on this. Get in touch with us. You can do it via Facebook, as long as you're careful with your settings, if you're on Facebook, or you can hit the website abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. There's the story-based commenting. It's very simple to use. Just click on that. You can leave a comment. You can also ring us, of course, on 02 833 1430.